Nikolai Shep Snyder, welcome to Sunday Night at the TSO.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Now, you have been with the TSO. It's been some time, though, so we have some get-to-know-you questions to get reacquainted with you. Are you ready?
I know. It's been what, like 4,000 years?
Something like that.
Thereabouts, right? Something like that. You know, before this week, I was thinking, like, what do I actually remember? Maybe you know the actual year it was.
2004, I believe, yeah.
2004, you see. I remember when I was younger, you talk to older musicians and they say, oh, yeah, I remember 20 years ago. They talk to other old musicians and they say, ah, you remember this 20 years ago? I said, how do anyone remember anything 20 years ago? And now I do remember 20 years ago. This is scary.
What do you remember from your time back then?
Well, I remember two things. I remember having an incident with the violin. Something happened where I needed very, very urgently to go to, like, a peg broke.
Oh my gosh.
I don't remember. Yeah. Right before, like, getting ready for, thank God, only rehearsal. And I remember being late for rehearsal because I had to, emergency violin shop procedure. And they put some kind of peg in and then we rehearse. That I remember because it's the kind of thing we all have nightmares over, no, musicians. One of the things is this thing about suddenly being late and suddenly, and it happened. And so that I remember sort of quite vividly. But I'm very happy to get to, as you say, to get to know the orchestra again after so many years. I'm sure there's been a big turnover. No, it's not the same orchestra exactly. I mean, by name, yes, but by people, I suppose. Lots of people have come into the orchestra in the last 20 years, no?
Yes, absolutely. There are still some members from back then, but there is definitely a lot of new energy and wonderful new talent in the orchestra, I think you'll find.
Wonderful. Happy to hear it.
So to our light get-to-know-you questions, who is your favorite composer of the moment?
You see, you did that well. I was about to say I don't have any favorite of all time, but at the moment, of course, it's Beethoven because we're doing Beethoven. Been in a quite a Strauss phase, Richard Strauss, and been concerning myself a lot with the tone poems. So, yeah, I suppose if you ask me right now, I would say Strauss.
What's your go-to drink at a bar on a night out?
Ginger beer.
Oh, you like it spicy?
Spicy but non-alcoholic. Yes, yeah,
excellent. If you could master any other instrument, what would it be?
Voice. I would love to be able to sing, like really sing.
Pizza or pasta?
Oh, no. You can't make me choose. That's like choosing one of your children. That's too difficult. All right, again, we'll do one of these for the moment. So right now, I'd go with pasta.
Excellent. Just to dive a little bit into your musical background, remind us, how did you find yourself as a violinist, first of all?
Well, you know, I mean, very well when you don't find yourself at all, you suddenly find yourself a violinist. You know, you suddenly realize, oh, I'm a violinist. Because we all start kind of young, or certainly too young to make any kind of real choices. In my case, it was just my parents thinking that, correctly so, that the playing an instrument, a musical instrument, should be part of any child's sort of upbringing. But I don't think they had any inkling that I would be that caught up by it, which I was after about a year. I think it became sort of my choice and what I wanted to do. So again, quite coincidental, but once it took hold of me, I never wanted to do anything else.
And I understand, I found this very interesting, that you went to study with the New York guru, Dorothy DeLay, who, I'll just remind listeners, taught me Dory, Nigel Kennedy, Kyung-hwa Chung, and others, decided she wasn't for you. You went to Boris Kushner instead. What resonated with you about his approach?
Well, it's not so much against Ms. DeLay. It's more that it was the wrong thing at the wrong time for me to be there. I felt that I was in need of figuring out a lot of things about the instrument, technical things, and I had just grown like a foot.
Oh, wow.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I was very young. I was 16 or just turned 17, and my arms were long, and, you know, you sort of have to reinvent yourself. You know, you play everything sort of by talent and by instinct, and then you go through that phase of first awakening, let's call it, you know, when you have your first sort of independent thoughts as a human being, you know, not just what you're told or by habit or because you like it, but you start thinking about things. And I realized that I needed to figure out the instrument again, or maybe not again, figure it out as an adult, as it were. And that I didn't feel I got. On the contrary, I felt that the atmosphere was very much centered around career and making a career. And I felt like I have to make myself a violinist, first of all. And so I started looking around, and I went to play for a couple of teachers, and invariably everybody would sort of listen and then start to teach right away, and how great and what a great talent and so on. And I remember arriving in Vienna and played for Kushner, dreary morning. I arrived straight from the train station, I remember. Went straight to his home. And I played for him sort of, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. And then he spoke for 10, 15 minutes, and that was that. Huh. And basically he said, well, sure, there's some kind of, solistic talent, I think was the way he coined it. But, you know, this doesn't quite work, and this isn't really. And he sort of gave me went through all the weak points, and it was exactly what I was waiting for. I was thirsty for somebody to not tell me that I was talented, but somebody to say, okay, you got to work. And so we started very thoroughly and really from scratch, you could almost say, you know, four lessons a week and open strings. And it was exactly what I wanted at that time. And it was a great time in my life being in Vienna.
When did conducting come into the picture for you?
I came a little bit later. I was fortunate as a young person. I played for Isaac Stern when I was about 12. And he prescribed, as it were, lessons in music theory and harmony and so forth. And my parents, with the help of Isaac Stern, got some funding to pay for private tuition. So I was exposed to sort of theoretical, formal analysis and harmony and counterpoint and so forth from an early age. Then I fell in love with parts of the symphonic repertoire. Some of the operatic, but then came that phase of being obsessed with the violin that we just talked about when I went to Vienna. And I was very much obsessed about that for about 3-4 years. And then I went to play for Barenboim. And my big wish was to not just to play with him, but to be able to take lessons and learn. And so that's what happened. And he was very generous and played with me. This was where I got a real exposure to the symphonic repertoire and the operatic repertoire. And after some years, it became an inner necessity. It was something I had to do. And it came really from, people always ask me, what was it? I say, well, it was actually the love of the repertoire. I just arrived at a point, and I remember the point exactly, when the tipping point, as they say, when I just felt, I have to do this. I can't play the violin and not be in touch with the operatic repertoire, with the big Mahlers, the big Strauss, you know, all of those things that you could never touch as a violin soloist. So that was really, that was the impulse, as it were, that came sneaking. But I suspect, looking back, the first seeds were already planted in my early teen years.
In Toronto, you are going to be leading an entire program, and we'll talk about various facets of it, but I'd like to start with the Beethoven Concerto, so you'll be soloist and conductor. What inspired you to bring this particular work to the TSO this season?
The Beethoven is, speaking as a violinist now, is our, I call it the New Testament, you know, the Old Testament would be the Bach solo, the solo sonatas and partitas. But I just mean in terms of importance, in terms of the weight that it carries. And so any chance I get to play Beethoven, I always say yes. And when we thought about me taking the whole program, meaning both conducting the second half, but also playing the first, I thought, well, the Beethoven is a wonderful piece because it stands alone. In the first half, it's majestic. And it's a wonderful way to rekindle the contact with the Toronto Symphony, get to know the orchestra, both as a conductor and as a violinist again.
Interesting about the Beethoven, which people may not be aware, it really didn't take off at the start. People didn't know how to take it. Maybe the soloist involved also didn't quite understand it, but it wasn't for quite some time until Joachim that this concerto began to take the place that it has now. What do you make of that as someone who knows the piece intimately?
Well, not too much. I mean, we know the quality of the piece now. And as you said, in those days, music wasn't performed and re-performed a lot. That happened just a bit after. It was mainly new works. You know, they would always play new works or write new works. And the only reason to have a concert really was when you had new music. And that changed, of course, a bit later with Mendelssohn, most notably in Leipzig. So it was partly natural that it would be this way. And partly, as you say, it might not have had the impact that it should have had if the violinist wasn't, they might not have had enough time to rehearse. You know, we know that these things were quite ad hoc.
So paired with the Beethoven is the Schumann Symphony No. 2. Talk to us about this work. And did you choose this one personally?
I think I did. I have a big love of Schumann. Some of the first symphonies that I felt compelled to do, there's something about Schumann which is incredibly human in its striving after the ideal. It kind of models itself after Beethoven, but with this added, there's a kind of fragility in the intensity that is incredibly, incredibly touching to me. And it's a composer that I've, for a long time, also as a violinist, I felt drawn to, not because of, but enhanced by the way that he thought about music. We have not always a lot of insight into the thoughts of composers. With Beethoven, we have the, you know, the sketchbooks where he would write thoughts or write down when he couldn't hear. So we know conversation books, I think they were called. But with Schumann, we have a lot of writings, both published and unpublished, about how he thought about music. And we also have quite an insight through Clara into his psyche and to his debilitating mental state. That, as I said, is not the reason that I love the music, but it enhances the affection that I have for him as a composer.
You play on an extraordinary instrument. It's Fritz Kreisler's Guarneri violin. Is this the instrument we're going to hear in Toronto?
It is. If I was in Toronto in 2004, I would not have had this violin yet. On this trip, I'll be playing the Guarneri that Fritz Kreisler once played. One of them. He had several, but this was the one he played between 1904 and up until the end of the First World War.
And I understand that this is actually the violin that he used for the premiere of Edward Elgar's concerto, which you recorded on the same violin?
Correct. We don't always know which instrument was used. The further back we go, the less we know. But in the case of the Elgar concerto, we know from a letter that Kreisler played all concerts between 1904 and 18 on this instrument. And since the premiere of the Elgar was in 1910, we are safe to assume that this was the violin indeed that he played. And so, of course, that's it's a very special thing to know that this was the very instrument on which the Elgar sounded for the very first time.
What is it like to have such direct contact or such a direct contact point with history?
Well, that's exactly it. But I feel we're doing that whenever we play music. We are constantly in dialogue with history. I think that's part of the fascination for me. It's the fact that we are creating something right now that will never exist again. And we are constantly thinking about it in an ideal state, which means the future. We're always thinking about how we can make it better. That looks into the future. And yet it is in constant conversation with not only the time in which it was written, but all time that has lapsed since then. If we start to look at music as more than a collection of notes, as beautiful as they may be, but look at it as a human enterprise, and then it's a result of not only the person who wrote it, but also the generations that came after that contributed to everything we know today and everything that has informed our music making. And that sort of being in contact with is, of course, extremely physical and manifest in an instrument. But honestly, I have the same feeling when we take a score. You know, we're in touch with that same idea, that Urgedanke, what they said, that primal idea of something that supersedes a single life. And I find that always very, very touching. And I think that what draws people to concerts still.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking time. And Toronto looks forward to welcoming you back. It's about time.
I'm very much looking forward to coming back and to being here again.